million if I were going to guesstimate.
I see, said Ernie.
All of a sudden, his palms began to sweat. He looked at the machine he'd just pumped $1,000 into. 50 or 60 million, Victor Fool had said. Of course he'd dreamed of having that kind of money, but actually having it had never been remotely probable. 50 or 60 million. He pulled the handle, and the machine display became a whirl of rapidly changing symbols. He eased up on the handle, and one of the electronic wheels stopped on a golden bar that framed the words, Fat Chance, in bright blue letters. The other symbols continued to change rapidly. He waited, trying to feel the right moment, then gave the handle a little jiggle and watched a second Fat Chance golden bar appear.
All right, he thought.
Now, any symbol but a lemon would give him a decent return for his play. The machine was, of course, carefully calibrated not to turn up another gold bar. The first two were supposed to make him think he'd just missed and pump another token or a dozen more into the machine. But a bell or a cherry or a rocket ship were always possible. He gave the handle a little pull toward him, then released it. The final wheel came to a stop. It was a third golden bar. With the words, Fat Chance, in bright blue letters, a bell started ringing somewhere very close, and after a pause, tokens began pouring out of the machine. Victor Fool stood open-mouthed, speechless, but he was nowhere near as surprised as Ernie as a loud siren added its noise to the bell and happy music began playing. In front of his face, a sign was flashing off and on, Super Jackpot. That was echoed in the back of his mind by a little voice saying,
50 or 60 million,
over and over and over. Chapter 13, Journal Number 723. The fascination of some men, it is invariably men, with implements of destruction never ceases to amaze me. While all collectors are by definition fanatics, the connoisseur of weapons takes this quality to an extreme, even if one grants in principle the historical and, I will even grant, the artistic appeal of certain weapons. Surely no civilized person can entirely forget their gruesome purpose. I find it particularly paradoxical that these aesthetes of destruction insist on having the finest weapons possible at their command, as if the victims would somehow be insulted to learn that their demise had been brought about by bargain basement artillery with second-hand ammunition. Fool and Armstrong came in sight of the hunter's camp just as another loud explosion shook the air. Armstrong involuntarily ducked. "Great goo! I hope they're paying attention where they're pointing that thing," he said. "It sounds like a cannon."
"For all we know, it is," said Fool.
"According to Ambassador Gottesman, they've come to Zenobia planning to shoot some dinosaurs. I don't even want to speculate on what kind of weapons they thought they'd need for that."
"Civilians!" grumbled Armstrong, just before another, even louder explosion caused him to duck again.
"What the hell?"
"It came from over there," said Fool, pointing to the left of the row of three luxury-grade ultra-tens facing them. "Let's find out what's going on."
They found the hunters in a group, huddled around a selection of weapons ranging from antique firearms to what looked alarmingly like a mil-spec rocket launcher, supposedly unavailable to the civilian trade.
"Let's try this one," said one of the group. "The salesman told me it'd knock anything up to 5,000 kilos right off its feet."
5,000? Said another. "Hell, if they got real dinos on this planet, not that I seen hide nor hair one."
"You won't either," said Fool, stepping forward.
"The local fauna are pretty diverse, but I've yet to see anything with hair, at least nothing indigenous." Startled, the hunters whirled around to face them.
"Captain Jester," said the man who'd spoken first, "we didn't hear you coming."
"I'm not surprised with all the noise you've been making," said Fool with a smile. "You really ought to wear ear protection if you're going to be using those big cannons. By the way, would you mind pointing that one the other way?"
He gestured toward the large-bore double-barreled rifle the hunter was cradling under one arm.
"Oh, yeah, sorry,"
said the hunter, Houston Obetter, Armstrong recalled. He shifted the weapon to one side and said,
"Ah, it ain't loaded anyways."
To prove his point, he pulled the trigger. The weapon roared, and Obetter nearly fell backwards from the recoil. At the same time, a gaping hole appeared in one of the ultra-tents.
"Hey, why don't you watch where you're shooting?"
came a woman's voice from inside the tent, shortly followed by the emergence of a compactly built brunette in shorts. Her hair was up in curlers, and her expression could have curdled milk at 100 yards.
"Oh, hello," she said. "I didn't know we had company."
"Captain, this is my wife, Dallas," said one of the other hunters, ostentation. "And don't you worry, honey. We'll make sure Houston doesn't shoot you again."
"With that thing, once would be enough," said the woman.
Then she turned to Fool, and a pleasant smile replaced her frown.
"Hello. You must be Captain Jester. I'm Dallas Treat. And who's this handsome young man with you?"
Fool introduced the blushing Lieutenant Armstrong, then turned back to the hunters.
"Gentlemen, what just happened is a good example of why I came out here. It looks to me as if you need to pay a lot more attention to weapon safety generally. For example, not knowing whether a weapon is loaded before you pull the trigger."
"Ah, it's not such a big deal," said the third hunter, L.P. Osho. "It could have happened to anybody."
"It darn near happened to me," said Dallas Treat. "What do you need all those big guns for, anyway?"
"I told you, honey. We came to this planet to hunt the biggest game in the whole galaxy," said Tation. "If you're fixing to go toe-to-toe with the biggins, you better have your boots on."
"What's that have to do with guns?" said Dallas, pouting. "Sometimes I think you say things that don't make sense just to make me feel stupid."
"Honey, you don't hardly need help with that," said Tation. "Now, if you'll pardon me, I need to talk with these here Legion officers that come to visit."
"We're not really here for a social visit," said Fool, cutting him off. "I just have one point to make. You are not allowed to fire weapons indiscriminately as long as you're this close to our base. I'm going to insist that you stop shooting until you're someplace where you can't hurt one of my people by accident."
"I see," said L.P. Osho. "Trying to get rid of us, are you?"
"Mr. Osho, I want to get rid of anything that puts my people in danger," said Fool. "If you won't use weapons responsibly, that definitely includes you. I can't make you go home, but I can take your weapons away as long as you're in territory under my command, or I can be a good deal of help."
"How's that?"
asked Opetter. Fool waved in the general direction of the Legion camp. "If you think you need weapons practice before you start hunting, I can give you guest privileges at our base firing range with Legion instructors. Or, if you'd prefer, I can help you move your camp out to a remote area with plenty of game, where you can fire away as you please. Your choice. But you just can't go popping off this close to my base. You don't even know where my people are at any given time."
"All right, I take your point," said Tation, quieting Osho, who seemed ready to protest again. "I reckon we aren't quite ready to move out into the country just yet. We'd like to hire a native guide or two for when we do move. You think you can help us with that?"
"Our Zenobian liaison officer could probably help," said Fool. "But will you promise to put the guns away, or at least not to use them except at our range until you're away from our base?"
"Fair enough, Captain," said Tation, and turned to look at the others. After a moment, they nodded reluctantly.
"Good then," said Fool. "I'll talk to my local contact and see if he can connect you up with a guide or two. And if you want to practice, just let me know, and I'll arrange for you to use our facilities. Thank you for your understanding, gentlemen. And now, I'm afraid Lieutenant Armstrong and I need to get back to base."
"All right, then," said Tation. "Just get us that native guide, and we'll be out of your hair right quick."
"Can't be any too soon for me," muttered Armstrong as the two officers turned. Fool shot him a warning glance, but he'd spoken too quietly for the hunters to hear. Together, they began jogging back to camp.
Willard Fool was back at his desk eating a late breakfast and reading the daily performance summary of his investment portfolio when his wrist communicator buzzed. That in itself was enough to alert him that something unusual was going on. The routine at Zenobia Base was sufficiently settled by now that Mother was unlikely to put a call through to him at mealtime for anything short of a genuine crisis. On the other hand, the last few days had been characterized by a series of mini-crises involving Barky, the AEIOU team, the training exercise that had gone haywire, the guests that State had sent for him to entertain. Warily, Fool lifted his wrist close to his mouth and said,
"What is it, Mother?"
"I've got Tully Bascom on the line, sweetie," came the saucy voice. "I told the old Ganuff to call back when you're awake, but he just says it can't wait. Shall I tell him to go away?"
"Oh, Tully's all right," said Fool, idly wondering where Mother had picked up Yiddish insults. "If he says it's important, I'm not going to make him wait."
"All right, but if he spoils your digestion, you know who to blame," said Mother.
Fool nodded silently, waiting. Something told him that Tully's call arose from the fact that his father was on Lorelei Station, sticking his nose into the casino business. He hoped Victor Fool wasn't being too tough on the staff. Abruptly, Bascom's voice came through the speaker of the wrist communicator.
"Captain, everything's hit the fan," he growled.
"Hit the fan?" Fool was nonplussed.
What's going on there, Tully?
I'll tell you what's going on, said Bascom. Between your know-it-all father and some third-rate con artist we never should have let into the joint.
Fool could hear shouting in the background, and Bascom said,
Excuse me, Captain,
and the line went quiet. Evidently, Tully had pressed the mute button. Then, after a pause, Bascom returned and began speaking again.
All right, Captain. This whole screw-up was my idea, and I've got to take the heat for it. You've got my resignation as of right now if you want it.
Wait a minute, said Fool. Con artist, screw-up, resignation. Tully, I don't have the faintest idea what you're talking about. Will you go back to the start and tell me the whole story?
All right, said Bascom. It all started with your father.
I'm not surprised, said Fool. Go ahead, Tully.
You remember we set up the $1,000 slots to get him to play, and you authorized a really big prize to lead him on? We all figured the odds were so long there wouldn't be a bug's chance on a hot griddle of our actually having to give the prize.
Yes, I remember, said Fool.
He suddenly sat bolt upright.
Don't tell me.
I am telling you, Captain, said Bascom, but that's not the worst of it. Your damn fool father wasn't satisfied with playing the slots himself. He had to go and give his chips to other people to play for him. Now I got some smirking greaseball sitting in my office.
Hey, buddy, show a little respect.
Fool could hear a muffled voice say in the background.
All right, said Bascom resignedly. Captain, the long and short of it is this. This guy sitting in my office is named Ernie Urquhart, and I'm sorry to tell you that thanks to your old man, the bum now owns a controlling share, what used to be your share, in fact, in the Fat Chance Casino. Here, I'm tired of looking at this sleazy bastard. Why don't you talk to him while I go get myself a couple of stiff drinks?
And the speaker again went silent while Fool sat looking stupidly at his wrist, waiting for someone on the other end to say something. Thumper and the group of legionnaires he'd eaten breakfast with arrived in the center of the parade ground just before Sergeant Brandy emerged from the modular structure that was the main building on Zenobia Base. The top sergeant of Omega Company was one of the largest humans Thumper had ever seen, although she was a good bit shorter than the Voltron legionnaire named Tuscanini.
All right, people. This is the Legion. Let's see something I could mistake for a formation, said Brandy resignedly.
She flipped through papers on a clipboard as the squad lined up, with only a minimum of grumbling. Thumper took a place in the middle of three rows toward one end, waiting to see what would happen. He'd been in formations before, and had learned not to be either too eager to catch the leader's attention, or too obviously trying to escape it. When everyone was more or less in place, Brandy looked up and said,
"We don't usually do roll call. I know all of you by now. But we got a new guy today, and I think it'd be a good idea to call roll until he gets an idea of who everybody is, and you know who he is. So, sound off when I call your names. You've all done this before, so don't make things any harder than they gotta be."
"Sergeant, I have a question," said Mahatma,
raising his hand in the front row. Brandy rolled her eyes.
"Give me a break, Mahatma. Can't it wait until after roll call? I'd like to get through at least that much before the philosophical seminar for today."
"But I just want to know how hard things have got to be," said Mahatma. "Do Legion regulations specify the degree of difficulty of roll call?"
"As a matter of fact, they do," growled Brandy. "They say you're supposed to answer when I call your name, unless you aren't here, in which case I mark you absent. Is that hard enough for you?"
"Maybe not for him, but it's a real challenge for some of these grunts,"
came a voice from the back of the formation. Brandy glared.
"Shut up, Roadkill," she barked.
Then, after a pause, she added,
"Haven't you Phoebes figured out I know your voices by now? Okay, come on. Let's hear a nice, clear answer when I call your names. Brick?"
"Here's Sergeant,"
said a thin human female just in front of Thumper. Brandy put a mark on her pad and continued.
"Cheap shot?"
"Yo,"
said another voice from the ranks. Brandy dropped the hand with the clipboard to her side and glowered.
"Look here, cheap shot. We're trying to show Thumper how we do things in Omega Company. How many times have I told you not to answer yo when I call the roll?"
"Bunch of times, Sarge," said Cheapshot. "Never convinced me, though. You want to show the new guy how we do things in Omega. You got to include the bad with the good, right?"
"Cheapshot's making sense,"
said another voice, and Thumper could hear still others murmuring their agreement. Then Brandy said,
"Shut up!"
And the murmurs stopped.
"Okay," she said. "Maybe you've got a point, Cheapshot. I'll agree that there's a lot of good things about the Omega way, but this is one of those times when I just want the good old Legion way. Believe me, there'll come a time when you'll thank me for this."
"If we thank you now, will you stop?"
said another voice from the ranks.
Shut up,
said Brandy, before the murmurs could get started.
If you just want to screw things up, I can make you stand here all day and never get to the fun stuff. I was going to take you out to the obstacle course today, so Thumper can get a look at how Omega runs it.
Suddenly, the entire formation fell silent, and Thumper could see the spines of his fellow legionnaires straighten as they came to attention in a way they'd only hinted at before. Even Cheapshot stood up straighter and said,
I mean, here, Sergeant.
That's a lot better,
said Brandy, bringing up the clipboard and checking off the legionnaire's name.
Dukes?
The rest of the roll call went so smoothly that even Thumper was impressed. What was it about the obstacle course that had such influence over Omega Company? Whatever it was, he was about to find out. Qual and his squad of Zenobians were out in the central compound of Zenobia Base again, busy at work as Sushi walked up to them.
Hey, what's new, Qual? He said, waving to the Zenobian flight lieutenant.
Qual looked up from the piece of equipment he and his crew were working on. It was apparently called a Sklern. At least that was what Qual had told Sushi it was. But after hearing Qual explain how no two Zenobians spoke their language in exactly the same way, Sushi wasn't sure he could assume that the words Qual told him for local objects had any universal validity for other Zenobians. The explanation still didn't quite make sense to him. But today, he had other things to think about, in particular, Rev's quest for the mysterious Leviz.
"Oh-ho, welcome, Rawfish," said Qual. "All goes rippingly with us today. Our alignments are exemplary."
Triff,
said Sushi. Then, recognizing an apparent opening, he went on.
Really interesting machine you guys have here. What does it do?
Qual's face assumed what Sushi took to be a serious expression.
Much of what it does is organized,
the Zenobian officer said. It took Sushi a moment to make the mental connection between the translator's wording and Qual's probable meaning.
Oh, I didn't mean to pry into military secrets, he said. Just curious about the apparatus, you know.
Oh, no offense received, said Qual calmly. In fact, I will tell you as much as I am permitted. The Sklern, the meaning of the name is, of course, obvious, is in essence merely a triaxial projector of non-randomized heebie-jeebies. As you can undoubtedly see, it is of considerably higher power than such units produced for the consumer market.
Right, said Sushi, little wiser than before.
He thought he grasped at least one point, though.
So this is basically the latest mil-spec version of one of your standard bits of hardware.
Outstanding, Rawfish, said Qual, slapping Sushi on the lower back. Your intellectual capacity is, as usual, of the highest grade.
Thanks, Qual, said Sushi.
He didn't think he knew much more than before he'd asked, but maybe if he mulled over Qual's answer, he'd come up with something.
Meanwhile, I've got a favor to ask you guys, he said. We're still trying to figure out how to adjust these translators to give the best results so you guys can understand us and vice versa.
That is hardly mandatory, said Qual. Misunderstanding is a fact of life. If you are a Zenobian, you would accept it as it is.
Maybe, said Sushi. But as it happens, I'm a human, and an inquisitive one at that, so I can't help tinkering with stuff that doesn't work quite the way it ought to. Here's what I'd like to do.
He pulled a small rectangular black object out of his pocket.
This is a mini recorder I'd like you guys to turn on while you're talking about things. It'll give us a good sample of your normal conversation, with three or four of you talking at once, and then we can analyze it for common patterns. Is that okay?
Qual looked at the mini-recorder with lidded eyes, then turned to his crew and spoke a few sentences. They replied, and a brief conversation ensued.
"We will do it," said Qual, "but only if you show me how to turn it off. I hope you understand me, Rawfish, my friend. Sometimes we need to talk about things we do not want others to hear."
Sushi nodded.
"Sure, I know what you mean. Even friends need privacy once in a while. See this red switch? Slide it to the left. Toward this red LED, and it's off. Back to the right, and it's on."
Qual took the device and slid the switch back and forth, then asked,
"There should also be some way we can resolve what it has recorded, and remove it if by mischance we have forgotten it was working while we talked."
"Yeah," said Sushi. "This is the playback switch, and this is the erase button. Let me show you."
A few minutes later, with Qual and his crew satisfied they knew the workings of the recorder,
so she said his goodbyes to the Zenobians and walked back to report to Rev. Rev and Duop looked up at him as he entered the room.
"They took it," he said.
"Good," said Rev. "Were them boys suspicious?"
"Maybe a little, but I showed them how it worked," said Sushi. "That seemed to satisfy them."
"Good," said Rev again. "I hope you didn't show them how everything worked."
"No way," said Sushi. "Unless they're experts in Terran mil-spec hardware, they'll never figure out that it's a transmitter as well as a recorder, and that you can't turn the transmitter off. You should be getting their signals now."
Sushi and Rev smiled at each other. They turned to the receiver Sushi had rigged up on a bench in Rev's office. Sure enough, a little light was blinking, showing that the unit was receiving. Attached to it was another small box, automatically recording every word the Zenobian said within range of the recorder Sushi had given to Qual. Now all they had to do was wait.
"You won... what?"
For once, Lola's open-mouthed surprise at Ernie was not for his having done something stupid. Just the fact that he hadn't done anything stupid, at least not anything she knew about yet, was sufficient cause for surprise as far as she was concerned.
"I won the casino," Ernie repeated, smirking. At least a big share of the stock. The old man told me my share is worth maybe 50 million Speltonians."
"I still don't believe it," said Lola. "They wouldn't offer that big a prize. Even if the odds are close to impossible, the risk of losing it is too—"
"Hey, you come down to the office with me and talk to the casino guys," said Ernie. "That's what I came to get you for, anyway. They want me to sign papers, do all sorts of other stuff. I may be dumb, but I ain't dumb enough to sign something I don't understand. That's what you're for."
"To sign something you don't understand?"
Lola raised an eyebrow.
"That applies to just about anything more complicated than a bar chit, and I'm sure not signing any of those for you. Well, if Fool's lawyers are as good as the rest of his staff, I doubt anybody could understand the papers they're going to want us to sign. We'll probably have to find a lawyer of our own to tell us what we're getting into, and I don't know who the legal heavies are on Lorelei. But give me a couple of minutes to fix my face, and we'll go see what they're trying to put over on us."
It took Lola more like half an hour. She changed into a dark designer suit that stamped her as a no-nonsense professional who insisted on getting the absolutely best quality without worrying about her purchases going out of fashion within 3 weeks. Lola had picked it up last year from an acquaintance who fenced for a haute couture shoplifting ring and considered it worth every penny it had cost, a serious outlay of money even after the five-finger discount. Her makeup took longer. She wiped it off and started over twice before she nodded and turned away from the mirror. In the end, she looked about 5 years older than her usual style, and 10 times more formidable. Nobody was likely to underestimate her, not now. It took her another 15 minutes of browbeating to get Ernie to change into something that might induce the Fat Chance Casino's legal staff to take him seriously. Then they boarded the local hover bus and headed back to the casino. The Lorelei buses catered mainly to casino workers, and the vehicle was nearly empty, this being the middle of the shift.
"What's our plan?"
asked Ernie, keeping his voice low, just in case the driver was spying for the Fat Chance.
"I don't really have one yet," said Lola, shrugging. "Find out what they're offering, and figure out how much more we can get by being a pain in their butts. That's what negotiating's all about."
"Well, they gotta make good on their promise, right?" said Ernie. "They say I own a hunk of the casino."
"And if you believe that, I've got a couple of nice planets for sale. Cheap," said Lola. "The best thing we can do is go in there expecting the worst, and let them surprise us by doing better. And if we can keep them from figuring out just where we're coming from, maybe we can even fool them into offering us something they didn't plan on."
Ernie nodded.
"I got it," he said. "We play the dumbs and wait for them to screw up."
Not quite, said Lola. "Your job is to sit there looking as if you're in charge, but let me do all the real talking. Just pretend I'm your lawyer, and you don't make any move involving money or your rights without my say-so. And I don't commit you to anything until I think we've got the best deal they're going to give us. Got it?"
"Sure," said Ernie. "Just what I said before. We play dumb and wait for them to screw up."
Lola sighed.
"Okay, have it your way," she said. "Just let me do all the talking."
The hover bus changed lanes and came to a stop. Across the street was the Fat Chance. Smiling bravely, Lola took Ernie's arm and steered him out to the sidewalk.
"This isn't going to be easy," she thought to herself.
Then again, the alternatives looked a lot worse.
"If you don't mind my saying so, sir,
I find it difficult to understand your father's involvement in this scheme, said Beaker over a hot cup of tea. It is hardly in character.
Oh, I'd have to disagree, Beaks, said Fool, looking up from his porter-brain computer. Dad's always had a stubborn streak. When he's got a point to make, he insists on ramming it down the throat of anyone who doesn't instantly agree. I didn't even mind giving him a chance to win my share of the casino, even though it was a long shot. Dad could run the place as well as I ever did, and the troops would still get the dividends from their shares.
And now you've delivered a controlling share to some unknown gambler, like a handout to some beggar on the street, sniffed Beaker. What if he tries to run the casino himself? He's likely to run it into bankruptcy in no time at all.
Fool scoffed. Oh, he can't do anything significant without winning a stockholder's vote. The fellows in Omega Company would never back him. They know Tully and Lex and the others too well to turn them loose just because the new fellow wants to make a change.
Do they? Asked Beaker sharply. What if this new fellow claims a new management team could increase profits? Or what if he offers a price for their shares that's too good to resist? It wouldn't be the first time stockholders have gotten greedy when somebody dangled cash in front of their noses.
Oh, it's not impossible, said Fool, leaning back in his chair and looking at his butler. We still don't know very much about this fellow, but I doubt he's got the capital to pull off that kind of trick. If he did, I think we'd have heard about him before he showed up at the Fat Chance.
A very dubious assumption, sir, said Beaker. The fellow could come from almost anywhere. If I were in charge of the casino, I'd be checking the databases to see if he has a criminal record anywhere in the Alliance.
I think we can trust Tully Bascom to find that out for us, said Fool. In fact, I think that's one of the things we'd know by now, if there were anything to concern us. My suspicion is that the big winner's just a regular fellow, maybe a salesman or a small businessman, who wanted to play with the high rollers and ended up getting luckier than he had any right to. When he realizes he's in deep water with all the big fish, he'll listen to reason and let the professionals handle things.
It would be pleasant to think there was such an elegant solution, said Beaker. Unfortunately, sir, in my experience, the ability to recognize that one is out of one's depth is a rare commodity, especially among those most in need of such insight. Far more common is an indomitable thickness of the skull bordering on complete absence of gray matter.
Before Fool could answer, Mother's voice came over the intercom.
Captain, we've got trouble, she said.
At that very instant, Chief Inspector Sneef of the AEIOU burst through the captain's door. She was one step ahead of Lieutenant Rembrandt, this morning's O.D.
Captain, I demand an explanation of this outrage, Sneef barked.
Do you, Chief Inspector? Fool's eyebrows rose ever so slightly. And what outrage do you want me to explain? I haven't noticed any outrages in particular, unless maybe you're talking about your dog.
Aha!
Said Chief Inspector Sneef, pointing a finger at the captain.
And exactly why do you mention our beloved mascot, Barky the Environmental Dog?
That ought to be pretty obvious, said Fool, staring at her. He's been attacking my people ever since he set foot on this planet. Sneef pulled herself up into a fair semblance of wrongly accused innocence.
Barky never attacks unprovoked, she said. He only responds to pollution or to direct harassment. He would not attack your people unless they were causing some kind of ecological problem, and he is trained not to injure the suspects he apprehends, merely to hold anyone who has detectable levels of a carefully delimited list of pollutants on their person or in their belongings until one of the human members of our team arrives to take charge.
I'm sorry, Inspector, but you'll have to find somebody else to swallow that line, said Fool. Your dog was chasing one of my legionnaires all around the dining hall just last night. You saw him, too. You were there.
I am surprised at you, Captain, said Sneef. The incident was clearly provoked by your legionnaire.
Beaker, who had been sitting quietly until now, snorted and said,
Provoked? Good Lord, madam. Provoked in what way? By walking to the salad bar to get his dinner?
I saw him taunting poor Barky,
said Sneef, lifting her chin and looking down her nose at the butler. Beaker looked up at her and said quietly,
Madam, you might discover more insight into the unfortunate animal's lack of manners by looking to the character of his human guardians than by postulating any provocative acts by his unlucky victims. If your dog is so poorly trained that he responds to this supposed taunting, then an objective observer would have no choice but to interpret that as proof of malfeasance on the part of his handlers.
Acting quickly before Sneef could respond to Beaker's indictment, Fool smiled and said, Have a seat, Inspector. Tell me what the trouble is, and we'll try to sort it out. Sneef glared at Beaker, then settled into a chair next to Fool's desk.
I'll get directly to the point, Captain. The last 2 days, I've heard your people firing weapons out in the desert, no doubt shooting at local wildlife, possibly even harming it.
I beg your pardon, ma'am, said Rembrandt. If our people are shooting at something, you can be dead certain they're harming it. That's what weapons do, you know.
Easy, Lieutenant, said Fool, raising a hand to quiet Rembrandt. He turned to Sneef.
Yes, Inspector, our people do shoot weapons out in the desert. Weapons training is an important part of the Legion's job, you know. But we aren't shooting at any local fauna or the local flora either, in case you're worried about that. We have a regulation practice range set up out beyond the perimeter. If you'd care to inspect it, I think we can even let you and your people fire a few test rounds.
I think not, said Sneef.
She stood abruptly.
However, I do intend to make certain your people aren't taking pot shots at the local animals. Be very careful, Captain. You military types might not think much of the AEIOU, but we have considerable power of our own when we decide to put it to use. Good day.
She turned and stalked out of the office, nearly knocking down Rembrandt as she went past.
Well, well, said Fool, after the door had closed behind her. I think we're going to have to do something about those hunters sooner than I planned.
I wouldn't delay, sir, said Rembrandt, shaking her head. She may be annoying as all get out, but she's right about the AEIOU's power, and we're already way over on the wrong side of her. If she ever gets wind of a real violation, we could be in worse trouble than anything headquarters has ever thought up for us.
You're right, Remy, said Fool. We've got to get those hunters out of the vicinity. The only problem is where we're going to move them to.
He rubbed his chin, then raised his wrist comm to speaking range and said, Mother, find Flight Lieutenant Qual for me. I think it's time we made use of his local knowledge again.
Your wish is my command, sweetie pants,
came Mother's mockingly sultry voice. Fool sighed. At least one thing was still more or less normal around Omega Company. Brandy and the training squad, plus a handful of other legionnaires who seemed to have nothing better to do, hiked a couple of kilometers out into the desert. Thumper gazed curiously at the exotic landscape around him. This was only the third planet he had been to in person, and, of course, the incident with General Blitzkrieg had resulted in his entire basic training squad being confined to camp, so he'd seen very little of Messina's world beyond the Legion boot camp and the spaceport. One thing for sure, Zenobia was certainly different from the urban areas where he'd grown up, on his homeworld, Tulun. He knew there were deserts and mountains and Arctic tundra there, of course. He'd studied the geography of Tulun in school, but being there was a whole new experience. He'd joined the Legion to see the galaxy, and here it was, right under his long, furry feet. If only his mama could see him now.
Finally, Brandy turned around and called out, All right, squad, take five. We want everybody in shape for the obstacle course.
The little group gratefully complied. The walk had been short enough, over mostly level terrain, but hauling along full combat gear, as per Brandy's orders, made it a bit of a chore nonetheless. Looking around, Thumper wondered what they had stopped for. The landscape here looked pretty much the same as every other chunk of desert they'd marched past, interesting in a wild and foreign way. But there was no sign of the kind of obstacle course Thumper had run in Legion Basic. More surprising, when Thumper turned around was the sight of a large fraction of Omega Company standing behind the training squad. Had they all heard of his record-setting obstacle course run back on Messina's world? Were they here to see if he was as good as he claimed, or had they come hoping to see him put in his place? Even the captain had come along. All the hints his fellow trainees had dropped about the obstacle course at Omega Company being different suddenly came back into his head. Just what was he going to have to do to prove himself to his new company? Thumper looked out into the desert again, wondering whether Omega Company might have created an obstacle course using only the natural terrain. Thinking about it, he realized it might be a logical response to the different environments the Legion must find on the different worlds it was sent to. If Omega Company was going to operate on Zenobia, it made plenty of sense to train in Zenobian conditions. His thoughts were interrupted by Brandy calling the squad to attention.
All right, people, form up and listen up.
She paused a moment while Thumper and his fellow trainees gathered in front of her, then went on.
We have a new member of the company, one that's never run the obstacle course with us before. Now, all of you know that we in Omega Company have our own way of running the obstacle course, and it's the best damn way in the Legion.
Thumper wasn't quite sure what she was talking about, but he joined in automatically with the rest of the squad in a general cheer. Legion Basic taught him that was a good thing to do, even when he didn't understand what everybody else was so enthusiastic about. He seemed to attract enough unwelcome attention from the sergeants and officers without asking for more. Brandy nodded.
Now,
Some of you may have heard that Thumper set a record on the obstacle course in Legion Basic. That's good. Omega Company wants the best Legionnaires we can get.
How did Doo-Wop get in?
Yelled someone from the back of the group, but Brandy ignored the voice and went on.
But now we're out in the field, and what matters is getting the job done, she said. Everybody has to get through the course, not just the two or three fastest guys.
Right on, Sarge,
said another voice from the back of the group, or maybe it was the same one. This time, others rumbled their agreement. Thumper began to wonder whether he'd been quite so wise to own up to his record-setting performance in Basic. Not that these Legionnaires seemed to hold it against him, but there was obviously a different standard in effect with Omega Company. He began to wonder just what was going to be demanded of him here.
Okay, then. Here's the drill, said Brandy. Thumper, you and the three Gambolts are the fastest here. So, your job is to get out ahead of the rest, identify all obstacles, and decide how to get them out of the way for the rest of the guys. If you can't do it by yourselves, come back to the group and get help.
Yes, Sergeant, said one of the Gambolts. His Legion name was Rube, Thumper remembered. How about the machine guns? You want us to take them out, or do you have another team for that?
Mahatma and Brick will do that, said Brandy.
All right. The course runs directly west 200 meters, then takes a turn to the northwest for another 200. You'll start at my signal. Ready? Go!
The Gambolts looked at Thumper, then all four of them slapped paws together.
All right, let's roll,
growled Dukes, and together they dashed off into the desert. Behind them, there was a roar as the remainder of the squad and most of the spectators fell in behind them. At last, Thumper began to understand. This was what Omega Company was about. He grinned and began moving forward, proud to be part of the team.
Chapter 14 Journal Number 727
In a truly orderly universe, a once-in-a-trillion-chances event ought to have the common courtesy to wait for someone to make a few million attempts to bring it about before manifesting itself. It says something very unpleasant about the universe we live in, that such an event can just as easily occur the very first time someone tries to bring it about.
Two men were waiting for Ernie and Lola in the Fat Chance Casino offices. One of them introduced himself to Lola as Tully Bascom, Chief of Gambling Operations. The other she already knew. Victor Fool, who wore an uncharacteristically pained expression. He looked Lola in the eye and said,
I remember you. What are you doing mixed up with this fellow? Or have you been all along?
That's really not germane to our business today, Mr. Fool, said Lola. In fact, I might ask you what you're doing here today. I didn't know you had a direct interest in your son's holdings here on Lorelei.
Bascom answered before Victor Fool could speak.
Mr. Fool is here as a witness to the events that were responsible for the situation we're in today. But you should know that I'm fully empowered to act for the Fat Chance Casino Corporation. In fact, this is pretty much a formality. I'm pleased to say that we're ready to give you $2 million free and clear, cash, check, gold, or Fat Chance Casino chips. We'll hand it over just as soon as you sign a few papers.
He gestured toward a sheaf of documents lying on his desk.
$2 million,
said Lola, raising an eyebrow, while frantically signaling to Ernie to keep his mouth shut.
That isn't quite what we came here expecting, Mr. Bascom. The terms of your prize offer were very explicit. A partner's share.
Do you really think so? Said Bascom with a predatory grin. As it happens, $2 million is a very generous payout. To tell you the truth, I'm not even quite sure what you think you've won. The terms of the jackpot on $1,000 slots were never precisely spelled out.
That doesn't matter, said Lola crisply. I hate to correct you, Mr. Bascom, but I have done some research into the Interplanetary Commercial Code as it applies to Lorelei Station. Your local government has managed to get in a number of provisions I'd have to describe as highly unfriendly to consumers, but I can assure you there are still some very explicit penalties for deceptive advertising, especially as applying to prizes offered in the casinos.
That may well be, young lady, said Bascom, shaking a finger. I won't argue the ins and outs of the law with you here. The bottom line is, we've got some damn fine lawyers, damn expensive ones, too, to argue our position. How are you fixed in that department? We can afford to tie you up in court for an awful long time.
Lola stared down at him.
And what do you want to bet the other casinos won't be licking their lips when they find out that the Fat Chance is trying to renege on your super jackpot? Especially after you've been stealing half their business by offering the best payouts on the station. The publicity value ought to be worth jillions to them. Come to think of it, they might even be willing to contribute to our legal fees.
Tully Bascom frowned.
"Are you threatening us?"
Lola laughed lightly.
"Oh, no, Mr. Bascom. Just reminding you that your casino isn't the only game in town. I think Captain Jester knows that, even if you don't. It's too bad he isn't here to talk to me. I bet he'd be a lot more reasonable."
Victor Fool gritted his teeth.
"If the boy were reasonable, we wouldn't be in this mess at all," he growled. "I swear, the brat hasn't done a sensible thing in years, starting with joining the Space Legion and abandoning the name his parents gave him. You'd think he'd have more respect for his own family."
"Now, Mr. Fool," said Bascom softly, "let's try to keep our focus on the issue at hand."
"Hey, I don't think he's that far out of line," said Ernie, speaking for the first time since the meeting had begun. "I know what it's like when you don't get any respect from people. Believe me, I know."
Victor Fool looked at Ernie and nodded.
"Yes, I expect you do," he said. "It's ironic. A fellow builds up something by his own efforts, and all of a sudden everybody around him thinks they know more about it than he does. I've seen it all too often."
"Hell, that's what happens when you let somebody else try to run your life," said Ernie sympathetically. "I bet if you and I just sat down together, without any middlemen, we could get this whole problem straightened out in jig time. Come to think of it, why don't we go have a drink and do just that? We'll probably be back with a done deal before these two have finished calling each other names." "You've got the right idea, old boy," said Victor Fool, standing up.
He put a hand on Ernie's shoulder.
"Come on, I'm buying. We'll have things sorted out in no time at all."
Tully Bascom looked up in alarm as Ernie stood up, grinning.
"Hold on, Mr. Fool. The captain hasn't authorized you to strike any agreements with these people."
Lola was already on her feet, hands on her hips.
"Ernie, I can't let you make any deals without my advice."
"Oh, encapsulate it," said Victor Fool, waving a hand. "You two buzzards want to dictate every pixel of this agreement, but that's the stupidest possible way to go about things. I'll tell you what's going to happen. This gentleman and I will sit down together and find a solution we can both agree on. Then we'll bring it back to you two to fiddle with the details. I'm sure there'll be plenty of detail work left for you, but for now, you're going to leave it up to the principals. And Bascom, if you don't like it, you can call up my son. I suspect he'll tell you to step aside and let two gentlemen arrive at something we can all live with. Come on, Ernie. Let's go get a drink."
He walked out the door arm in arm with Ernie, leaving Bascom and Lola staring after them, open-mouthed. Sushi was wearing a set of headphones and carefully adjusting dials on his device when Doo-Wop walked in.
"Hey, man, what's up?" said Doo-Wop. "We figured out what Qual and his homeboys are talking about yet?"
"Shh," said Sushi, pointing to the device. "I finally got them pretty well tuned in, and I've learned one thing already. Qual was right. They all speak slightly different versions of their language."
"Huh, who'd have thunk it?"
said Doo-Wop, pulling up a chair.
"What are they jabbering about?"
"Mostly technical stuff so far," said Sushi. "Adjusting that machine, the Sklern, Qual called it, and in between joking about something. Here, you give a listen."
He took off the headphones and reached up to turn on a speaker.
"We ought to rotate the two Grimbugs upward," said one Zenobian voice.
"Two and a fifth," came another, this one recognizably Flight Lieutenant Qual.
"That'll just clear the Faffleweed cluster."
"Working on two and a fifth,"
answered the first voice. Then, in a different tone,
"Hey, Flort, did you view the tail vipers last sundown?"
"Sir, they raise a stench in my nostrils,"
said a third voice, apparently Flort.
"They haven't had an efficient leaper since Blurg retreated to his domicile."
"Watch it, Zoot," said Qual. "Don't overcrank."
"Tightly focused at two and a fifth,"
said the first voice again. Then Zoot added,
"Don't underrate Klug. Then he's into league a little longer than an exemplary leaper he'll be."
"Klug is without grace,"
glowered Flort.
"He could take lessons from a griff."
"This shit don't make no sense,"
said Doo-Wop, drumming his fingers on the table next to the equipment.
"I think they're talking about some kind of sports team from their home city," said Sushi. "Hard to tell exactly, because the words don't all translate into anything we have an exact equivalent for."
"That's for damn sure," said Doo-Wop.
"I think Rev's looking for a Weefle and a Vittle Wharf.
If it wasn't such a sweet deal working for him instead of pulling regular Legion duty, I'd tell him so myself."
Sushi looked at him with raised eyebrows, then said,
"Well, I don't see any percentage in ruining a good scam either. But you know, even if Rev's ideas never pan out, this whole Zenobian language thing is fascinating. If I could figure out a way to rig translators to deal with it, I bet there's a lot of money to be made.
so I'm not just in this to get out of other work. And if you're not just looking for a new way to goof off, it could work out to benefit you, too.
Doo-Wop looked doubtful. I don't know, man. You listen to a bunch of crazy stuff long enough, you could maybe end up crazy yourself.
Over the speaker, Flight Lieutenant Qual's voice said, "Now, doxin' up the regulator for a test projection."
"Got it, Lieutenant," said Zoot.
Then, after a pause,
"Regulator energetically doxined, ready to project, sir."
Doo-Wop waved a hand.
"See what I mean? Nothing but crazy stuff. Maybe it's worth a million, I don't know."
"Klug seems graceful enough for me," said Zoot over the speaker. "The purpose is not the senses to bedazzle, but to advance the pellet."
"Klug cannot retain the pellet in his claws long enough to advance it," said Flort. "He raises a continual stench in my nostrils."
"Maintain the doxinization, or we will be forced to recommence," said Qual sternly. "Your sporting chatter can be retained for a more propitious occasion."
"Double vision, Flight Lieutenant," said the other two Zenobians,
almost in unison.
"Double vision?" said Doo-Wop.
"I told you this is crazy stuff. You keep listening to these lizards, you're going to end up with scales on your ass."
"So I should tell Rev you're tired of working on this project?"
said Sushi, with a mischievous expression.
"I hear tell Remy's asking for volunteers for a heavy construction squad."
Hey, Sushi, just kidding," said Doo-Wop.
"Lizard talk is the real deal for me. What did you say you wanted me to do?"
"Well, for starters, you could run down to supply and get about a dozen blank recording cartridges," said Sushi. "We don't want any of this immortal Zenobian conversation to get lost just because we ran out of cartridges, do we now?"
"Cartridges coming up," said Doo-Wop,
and headed out the door. Sushi watched him leave, chuckling, then put the headphones on again. Maybe there was a way to broaden the standard semantic filtering circuits.
"What do you think they're up to?"
asked Lola. She and Tully Bascom were nursing twin glasses of synthescotch on the rocks in his office, waiting for Victor Fool and Ernie to return.
"Hell, I'd just like to know where they are," said Tully. "No sign of them in the casino lounge, and the security system says nobody's entered Mr. Fool's room in the last 3 hours. They must be outside the Fat Chance, and I don't like that one damn bit."
"Neither do I," said Lola. "I hope they at least took Mr. Fool's bodyguard along with them."
"Well, there's no sign of him either, so that's the way to bet," said Tully.
He took a long sip of his drink, then glanced at the computer monitor on his desk.
"Just how far do you trust your guy, by the way? Is he gonna listen to sense once they come back to us?"
"I trust him just about as far as you trust your guy,"
said Lola, staring at him over the rim of her own glass.
"Which, from the way you've been talking, is about as far as you can throw a small asteroid two-handed."
"That's what I was afraid of," said Tully glumly. "I've got one advantage over you, though."
"What's that?"
"My guy is my boss's father," said the casino manager. "He can get me in a bunch of trouble, and he's as stubborn as any man I've ever seen. But I don't think Captain Jester is going to fire me just on the old man say-so, not unless he's got some real reason to believe I've really screwed up. Your guy, on the other hand..." Lola grimaced.
"Yeah. Does the phrase loose cannon mean anything to you? And since he's the one who pulled the handle on that machine of yours, Lorelei Law says he's the one who gets the last word. Well, I've talked him out of stupid things before, and I can do it again."
"Lorelei Law is an extremely flexible instrument," said Tully Bascom, grinning. "Considering who made it, that shouldn't surprise anyone. I think we can work with that."
"As long as you don't work with it to cheat my client out of what he's got coming to him,"
said Lola firmly. She stared at her empty glass, then looked up and said,
"What exactly are the terms you are offering on that jackpot?"
"If you want to know the real truth, we didn't expect anybody but Victor Fool to win it," said Bascom. "We set up that whole bank of slots with odds that ought to have dissuaded anybody with brains from playing it, and a price that should have clinched the deal."
"What were you doing that for?"
asked Lola, setting down the glass.
"The old skinflint got the idea that our payouts were too generous," said Tully.
He'd emptied his glass quite some time before.
"Victor Fool thought he could prove it by playing a system, and we decided to let him, teach him a lesson the hard way. Captain Jester approved it, too, but who the hell expected $1 billion to 1 shot to pay off in less than a week?"
"Well, I'm just as glad it was my guy who hit the winner,"
said Lola.
"Remember, though, I'm here to make sure the casino honors its promise. You offered a share of the casino, and that's what you're going to deliver, or I'm going to yell so loud they'll hear it on Altair 4.
Yeah, I hear you," said Tully. "We'll play it as honest as we can afford to, don't you worry. What worries me is whether those two gentlemen are going to cook up something neither one of us can live with."
A gentleman's agreement between those two is the last thing we need, agreed Lola. But if Victor Fool doesn't have the authority to cut a deal for the casino, why are you worried about him running off to talk with Ernie? If he can't bind you to anything, you've got nothing to lose, right?
Bascom leaned back in his chair and stretched his arms above his head. One thing you learn in this business, he said, you've always got something to lose, and there's always somebody standing there ready to pick it up and run away the minute you drop it. So, you cover all your exits is the only way to play the game, which is why I'm worried about the old man and about your guy, too.
They're wild cards, said Lola, nodding.
Worse than that, said Bascom. I can figure the odds on a wild card and make allowances for it. Your guy? I thought I had some idea what he was, but now I'm not so sure.
I've known him longer than most people, and sometimes he even scares me, said Lola. What about Victor Fool?
I don't even want to think about Victor Fool, said Tully.
He reached for the synthescotch.
Which is why I'm having another drink. How about you, sister?
Lola nodded again.
First good idea I've heard today, she said.
Hey, Soosh, quitting time,
said Supernat, sticking her head through the door. Behind her was Toscanini with a baleful stare that might have worried Sushi if he hadn't recognized it as the Voltron's habitual expression.
Sure, said Sushi, stretching his arms above his head. It doesn't look as if anything's going to happen here anyhow. Give me a minute to put it on auto for the night, and I'll be right with you.
All right, said Supernat. Just don't make Tusk start counting, okay?
Toscanini's scowl became even more menacing.
Why no counting? I count good as anybody, he said.
Yeah, said Supernat, grinning. Now all we have to do is teach you when not to do it.
She gave him a friendly elbow in the short ribs. While the two legionnaires bantered, Sushi quickly ran through his routine to set up a listening apparatus for automatic recording of the Zenobian's conversation. He didn't expect to find any great amount of material when he came back. The natives tended to end their workday around the same time as the legionnaires. In fact, Flight Lieutenant Qual was often seen in the lounge, having a drink with the captain and the other legion officers before dinner. Almost without thinking, he glanced at the translated text scrolling across his computer screen before turning off the display for the night. That was when the word Leviz jumped out at him.
Hold on a minute, guys, he said. Something weird's happening here.
Sure, like that's anything new, said Supernat. This whole outfit is about the weirdest experience I've ever had anything to do with.
Uh-huh,
said Sushi, peering intently at the screen. He spoke a soft command, and the text scrolled backwards. He leaned closer, muttering softly.
Uh-oh, said Supernat. This looks like one of those minutes that turns out to be all night long. Hey, Sush, are you coming or not?
He's standing still, looks like to me, said Toscanini.
Yeah, said Sushi, turning around to meet their gazes. Look, guys, something really interesting just came up. It'll take me a little while to figure it out. Why don't you go ahead and I'll catch up with you?
Sure, said Supernat, shrugging. We'll save you a seat. Just don't expect us to save you any beer.
Yeah, okay, said Sushi,
obviously only half listening. Then he said, more to himself than any listener,
Why didn't I think of this before?
But Supernat and Toscanini were already gone.
Where in Goo's name are they?
Tully Bascom stared through bloodshot eyes out the window of his office at the neon-lit landscape of Lorelei. He and Lola had been waiting for Victor Fool and Ernie to come back for over 6 hours. Several discreet but increasingly urgent searches of the hotel and surrounding area had produced no sign of the two delinquents.
Your guess is as good as mine, said Lola. I'd have bet on the nearest bar, but we've tried that. The nearest dozen bars, I think. And you say they're not in Mr. Fool's room?
Security says no, and I trust my security people, said Bascom. More than I trust Victor Fool, let alone your guy.
Lola set down her drink. She really didn't need any more, not if she wanted to have some semblance of her wits about her when Ernie and Fool Sr. returned with whatever crazy deal they'd agreed on, assuming they did agree on something. She looked Bascom directly in the eyes and said,
Look, my guy just wants you to deliver what you said you were going to pay to the jackpot winner, a partner's share of the casino stock.
She paused.
I don't see how it's our problem if you didn't intend for him to win, not if you're running an honest business the way you claim you are.
Bascom drew himself up straight and said, with as much dignity as he could muster after four stiff drinks,
I wish I had any reason to believe you two are as honest as the Fat Chance Casino. We're as honest as anybody in this business, a lot more honest than most, and if you've done your homework, you ought to know that.
All right, I'll give you that much, said Lola.
The point is,
My client, Mr. Urquhart, is entitled to the jackpot for the machine he played. The casino has no rules posted concerning any eligibility for prizes or jackpots, other than having to be of legal gambling age, which on Lorelei means tall enough to reach the handles of the slots. My client qualifies.
What if he obtained the winning chip fraudulently? Said Bascom. We've got precedents covering that.
Lola shook her head emphatically.
Fraudulent? How do you get fraudulent? Vic Fool gave Mr. Urquhart a chip to gamble with. He played and won, and gave Mr. Fool back half his winnings, as agreed up front. The remaining chips were his to do with as he wanted. He could have thrown them into a trash disintegrator if he wanted. In fact, I bet you'd like that.
Nah, not really, said Bascom. There's always a small percentage of chips that never get cashed in. The customers take them home for souvenirs, or lose them down a drain or someplace else where they never get found. Sure, it's money we don't have to pay out, but the legal beagles and the bean counters get headaches about it. They always worry that somebody's going to show up one day with a huge space chest full of chips and clean out the bank. Outstanding liabilities, they call it, and when they worry, that gives me headaches.
Lola stared at him for a long moment, then nodded.
Okay, I guess I do believe you, she said. But if you're so worried about what the bean counters and the shysters think, why'd you even offer a deal like the one Ernie won? Didn't they scream bloody murder?
We never asked them, said Bascom. I thought it up, and Captain Jester approved it himself, and that was good enough. We didn't expect anybody but the captain's father to play at such lousy odds, and if by some quirk of the odds the damn machines did pay off, the captain didn't see anything wrong with passing a share of the casino to his old man. As long as it stayed in the family, he figured he wouldn't have to worry about how it was being run.
What? He thinks his whole family has the golden touch?
No. He just thinks they're smart enough to leave something to the professionals when they can't do it themselves, said Bascom.
He shook his head and continued.
Now that I've put him in the hole this way, I wouldn't blame him if he decided to get in some new professionals to run the joint.
He sighed and took another sip of his drink.
Well, you're not fired yet, said Lola. Look, as long as my guy gets a fair shake out of this, he's not going to let them cut you loose.
Easy for you to say, said Bascom. You think you're going to have any influence on what Captain Jester decides to do? Your guy may think he's won a partner's share, but control of the casino still rests with the majority of the stockholders, and I wouldn't bet on them listening to anybody but the captain.
Hey, I don't want to see you in the ejection pod,
said Lola, reaching over and putting her hand on his forearm.
We just have to find something the two of us can agree on, and when Fool and Ernie come back, we convince them that it's what they really wanted all along. If you can get Mr. Fool on board, I'm sure his son will listen to what he says.
If he does, it'll be the first time in years, said Bascom. But I agree. We've got to be ready with something sensible before our principals come back with their proposition. What do you think of this idea?
The discussion went on into the late hours. Chapter 15 Journal Number 732 The rationalist is convinced that every sophont is at bottom predictable, acting according to consistent, if not necessarily already well-known, rules. The mystic, for his part, believes that every creature conceals within its breast some element of the wild and unpredictable. Of the legionnaires who play parts in this ongoing chronicle, perhaps young Sushi best characterizes the former point of view, with Rev perhaps the most obvious advocate of the latter. The realist, a label I believe I may fairly apply to myself, is aware that both of these philosophies have merit. Most of us are predominantly creatures of habit and pattern, but even the quietest of us has depths from which the most unexpected actions can sometimes emerge. Tonight, Thumper was standing perimeter guard duty for the first time. Brandy led him out to the position he'd be occupying to show him the ropes and give him a word or two of advice.
The biggest thing to remember is that you've got instant comm contact with Mother if anything weird happens, said Omega Company's top sergeant. Don't worry about bothering her. First of all, she loves to talk. And second, whatever's going on, she's probably talked to a lot of legionnaires in exactly the same spot you're in, so she may have a pretty good idea what's happening. And third, if you really do need help, she can get it to you faster than anybody else. Got the picture?
Yes, Sergeant, said Thumper, peering out into the darkness surrounding the base. He felt small and alone, even with the Zenobian stun ray he cradled in his arms. Brandy nodded.
And the second thing to remember is, even though we're on a strange planet light years away from your home or mine, there's not really much that can go wrong. The only other humans on the planet are the AEIOU team over there, and the hunters who brought you here, and none of them are going to invade the camp.
though if those hunters get boozed up, they might do something stupid. The Xenopians are our allies, in fact. They're the ones who invited us here. And the Nanoids, the microscopic colony intelligence that the captain and Beaker found out in the desert, nobody's seen them since the captain sent his robot double to deal with them. Not much chance they'll decide to